there's a lyric in a Mark Hurd song. Sometimes I lie awake at night and think back just as far as I can. The sound of my father's laugh at night. The thought of Sputnik in free flight. There are the people that are in our lives that we aren't. I don't mean they're people that we meet like in a formal way. They are people that are mashed up against our life. To use a fancy word, they are juxtaposed against our lives. So I don't mean it's like you're introduced to your special friend and then you've met that person. I mean, you're in life with certain people that you're meeting them, I guess, at some point, but it's more like you're doing life with them. And I wanted to talk about three examples of that have had an effect on me lately because I've just had time to think. I will start with, in fourth grade, I was in class at Greenbrier Christian Academy in Chesapeake, Virginia, and I believe it was like 1984, and small class, we met in a modular trailer. Some of the school was in, I kid you not, a fundamentalist Bible FM radio station. Oh man, the call numbers are just on the tip of my tongue. It might have been something like WRBI. And what I'm thinking about is the cast of characters that I was just in class with. I don't remember all of them. But there was one particular other, like, 9 or 10-year-old named Chris. And Chris, I watched him. He had been at the school since maybe kindergarten. I had just showed up in fourth grade. And after probably not more than a few days of being in class with him, I realized Chris was one of the funniest kids I'd ever been around. He was just constantly doing voices and characters, and I noticed that he was great at handling others' interest in him being funny. He could deliver funniness on cue. And that was the first memory I have of some sort of peer being particularly funny. I guess I had watched funny cartoons or maybe seen some sort of comedian like Bob Hope or maybe Johnny Carson. Although, you know, when you're a young kid, you don't really get jokes in a stand-up kind of way. But you can get, like, silly sort of kid jokes from your kid friends. And what I experienced from this fellow Chris, and I don't know that Chris and I were ever friends so much as sort of fourth grade gentle kids of comedy. But my game respected his game greatly. I don't know that his game even knew that my game was there. Because I was always watching how funny he was in class. One example, Chris watched a fair amount of, like, Kung Fu Ninja movies on television, which came on some amount back. This is, like, barely when cable was around. I don't even know if any of us had cable TV back then, really. But the Saturday afternoon, like, local UHF station or whatever would play a lot of these kinds of, like, old movies from, like, I guess China. And here's the thing. There would be, like, fighting, and there would be overdubbed English over the Chinese. And these martial artists, most of the time without shirts, and they're just jumping all over the place and fighting each other. And Chris had figured out how to move his lips alternately from the words that he actually was pronouncing, and could say something like, "I would like to borrow your pencil," but his lips would be moving all over the place in a non-natural way. And I can see it now, the crazy look on his face when he would do it. He would do it with a straight face, and it was phenomenally interesting and funny. Funny. And it was absurd. And Chris was doing that kind of thing a lot. And he was a master of the quiet, stealth joke. And again, this is someone that was just mashed up against my life. I don't know that I was looking for him, but it made a profound effect on me about humor and being funny. And of course, he got a lot of attention, both for good and ill. I mean, he got attention from, like, the fourth grade girls, and then he also got attention from the fourth grade teacher, Miss Conley. I went on in my life to care a lot about being funny, to care a lot about what is comedic timing, what is silliness, because of Chris. And I want to move on. Another situation in my early life, I was now in, this is fourth or fifth grade, in our very next door neighbor. It was the first time I'd ever met anybody like this. Again, not because I was trying to meet them or they were trying to meet me, but we were just in life together. And Dr. Holman, who is this cartoon level academic, always dressed up in a suit, had these older style glasses, had the hair of an academic, and was a Bible scholar at what was originally CBN University, and it eventually became Regent University, which it is to this day. But in this neighborhood subdivision called Fairfield, he moved in right next door. And my dad worked at CBN and still does even today. This is all part of the Pat Robertson organization. And Dr. Holman, who also, now that I think of it, he also went to Kempsville Presbyterian Church, which my family and I went to. And I was seeing Dr. Holman and waving to him, and he was keeping a load of classes going. He was a professor. I don't have any clue where he came from, but he was, when I was like 9 or 10, he was probably like 50, 55. I'm thinking, you know, a few years older than my dad. Dr. Holman was married to a first-generation Jamaican woman who had a thick Jamaican accent. Her name was Rose. And because, I guess the short of it is, I had never been around a mixed-race couple that closely, and that was not something that my family, all of which were like, my mom's side was deep Southern, and my dad's side was sort of Southern with a twist of Midwest, because dad was from near the Oklahoma border of Arkansas. And that was different. And then they had two adopted daughters who were in their teens. And the reason that this is significant as I look back on it is I have worked now in higher education and in colleges for towards 18 years. And Dr. Holman painted a picture of what an academic looked like and felt like. He was stereotypic in his love of the life of the mind. And I didn't know anybody like this. And he didn't have any young boys in his life. And I mean, he had these lovely daughters that were teenagers, and I was kind of afraid of them because they were teenage girls, and I lived next door. But there was a little bit of like a kind relationship that he took towards me and I to him, and I eventually cut his grass, like I mowed his grass. And Dr. Holman was infamous for, in the early years that I lived by him, he did not even know to put oil in his lawnmower. And so once we saw him that one day with a bunch of like white smoke coming out of the top of his lawnmower, somehow we found out, I guess maybe Rose Holman, his wife, told my mom at some point, you know, Charles did not put any oil in it. That's what they said he did wrong when he took the mower back. And he said he never knew that was something you did. And that there's a little bit of a kind of like classism that sort of was beneath the surface of the laughter in my family about that. No one in my family was a PhD, but we always knew to put oil in the lawn mowers. And so that was like a multi-year long joke. And it's just the things that I remember. But the point was that it was, in a way, it was kind of okay because Dr. Holman was so studied and learned as a Bible professor at CBN University, Regent University. And so just to think about the first academic I ever knew and the things I knew about him and the ways that I related to him, in many regards because of the ways that my family sort of taught me to think about academics. And because he was, again, because he was at sort of a very approved institution, certainly in no way like a liberal arts arrangement. It was very much, finally, somebody knows the original Greek and is teaching the right, you know, finally someone has the right way to teach the Bible. And Dr. Holman knows. He was a good guy, right? He's not encouraging a life of research or something. He's encouraging a life of you now have the truth. So he was very safe in that regard. And this was how I knew Dr. Holman was a good man. And I even remember by the time I was in high school, I had a question or two about the Bible that my parents couldn't answer. And I went to Dr. Holman, and Dr. Holman died probably about 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. And then his wife passed. I hadn't seen them in many years. I'd moved away from that area. I would have liked to have seen him again before his passing. He was somebody that, again, my life just pushed up against. And it made an impression on me that I still think about literally 30 years later. The last installment of people that my life meshed up against is a teacher in eighth grade. I had left Greenbrier Christian Academy to go to another Christian school and then came back. My parents helped me decide I wanted to go back to Greenbrier Christian by junior high. So in seventh, eighth, and ninth grade, I was back at Greenbrier, which had grown and become more, just more sizable. And maybe they had also opened themselves up to a bit more, classical kinds of study, and maybe a bit more openness towards the humanities. And I set all that up to say I met this fellow who was probably 25 years old as a teacher in eighth grade. And here's the reveal. We studied English, we studied grammar, And then I think every couple of weeks we shifted around to literature, and then we mostly would go back to grammar. And what Mr. Brennan would have us do is he would have all of us in class keep a journal, a diary, a record of whatever we wanted to write about. And they were due, I believe they were due once every academic term. So this would be like every 2.5 months or something. I think there's normally 4 academic terms in my school. Mr. Brennan encouraged us to write anything we wanted, in any style we wanted, about anything we wanted. We just had to write. So it was kind of this early artist way, if you know that. I think Julia Cameron is famous for just, hey, your morning pages. This was an early incarnation of that, and by like 15 years or something. But I had no idea that would be a bit of encouragement that would shape my own relationship with myself, like to a high level. No one in my family, bless them, would have thought that was normal to keep a journal or a diary or something. Maybe a devotional, maybe like a Bible workbook, sure. But something with just like a blank page and a pen, or in a spiral bound notebook and a pen where you wrote about your life, that just no one, it's no one's fault. This just was not normal, and no one knew about that in my friends or my family or extended family. And that also, if that did happen at all, it was something that would have happened in a feminine context, like the classic diary with the locket. would have been like something we would see on TV, or in some kind of context that a female would keep this. But this was not the domain of something a man would do, a young man. All this to say, I find myself sitting down to write, and several pages could come out at one time, and I always was relieved to. And I'm 13, maybe 14 in 8th grade, and the experience of articulating, oh, this like junior high retreat with church is happening, and I think I'm going to end up participating in the one skit with the one girl, and I'm really nervous about this, but also excited. And I knew Mr. Brennan was going to read it. But his rapport, one thing I haven't explained, his rapport with us, especially us young men, was very witty and funny. And he was a particularly handsome man, if I can just say that. I mean, he was kind of an iconic. He was like this thin, tall, had a large, pointed nose. But it was like sort of just iconic. It wasn't unflattering. It was just like, man, what a dude. He had a stylish haircut as a young teacher. In this school, there was not really very many young teachers anyway. And so he stood out on a couple levels. And he was funny, and he was culturally aware of what movies were out and what albums were out. And at the Christian school, we were not encouraged, and we were actually discouraged from participating in pop culture, lest it lead us astray into sinfulness. Mr. Brennan, although he never tried to subvert the authorities of the school or something, he made us feel like, oh my gosh, there's so much good music happening, like on the radio, and there's so many cool movies happening that are rated R. And of course, we weren't even old enough to see the movies, but he was like, oh man, this is an amazing movie. I think he told me about Silence of the Lambs, like one-on-one one time. He's like, well, you're not old enough to see it, unless you sneak in. And I did see it eventually before I was old enough to see it in a theater. So I was turning in every quarter voluminous pages I had written. Oh, and one thing, Mr. Brennan would write notes in the margins, not a ton, but he would comment, "Oh, I like the way you put that. Wait, what did you just say about her? Question mark, funny face." And he would occasionally be like, you know, some, he might write a very brief quote, just something pretty innocuous, but something sort of wise. And then it's like, you got it back, you know, and he passes you your own journal back. Not right away. It usually took him weeks to grade these things, but you get it back. And then you kind of slowly read back your own stories to yourself, but you know that Mr. Brennan has read them. And perhaps thinks of you in a cool way, and you wanted for him to think of you in a cool way because he was cool. And I can't imagine my life having been any other way. I mean, at this point, I'm constantly impulsively journaling, capturing, thinking about capturing, failing to capture, and feeling slightly guilty. There's a desire to synthesize thoughts and feelings that is a way for me to exist in the world. And I think about with the situation with the English teacher, Mr. Brennan, I'm like, man, what a mystery that I pushed up against him in my life, and I had a chance to know him at the time that I did. Back it up to the other fellow I mentioned, Dr. Holman, an academic. Interesting. And now I'm a part of a large research university around, even a divinity school with biblical scholars. Interesting that I had a neighbor, really, he was there my entire, I was at this one house, the neighborhood I mentioned, I was there all the way through graduating high school. So I was there like, let's see, 8 years or so. And it's so interesting. And, you know, had I not pushed up against Dr. Holman, how would I have gotten more information about what academia is, or how to understand professors and their lives a little bit? Back it up further to the young man I met, Chris, in fourth grade, and watching in real time someone with comedic timing and observing someone that made me laugh so hard as a young man, that was not on TV. It was, again, the first time I had seen someone do this beside me who was my age. These are pieces of my life that profoundly affected how I relate to reality. And there's almost innumerable more, you know, people I could probably come up with, but I thought of these three today. And I don't have a big closing like, ta-da, other than to say it's powerful. What do you think? Is this something that you are stimulated by? If this little podcast experiment that I've been putting out there is interesting, you could always find it on iTunes. Give it a couple stars. You could shoot me an email, lilwhq@gmail.com. I really appreciate you listening. It's late at night. I gotta go to bed.